CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be. Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress-them-on-the-third-date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hi, dear listeners. This is Kate Riga. I'm here to make a quick pitch that you consider becoming a TPM Prime member. TPM has used the member model for over a decade now, and our loyal members are the only reason we've been able to weather the turbulence of the media landscape and avoid the fate that has befallen so many other independent outlets. For $70, you get no paywall, fewer ads, access to the Hive member forum, a members-only newsletter, and more. For $140 a year, you get all of that, plus no ads at all. Without our members, there is no podcast, not to mention that I'm out of a job. Thank you so much for listening and supporting us. We couldn't do it without you.
This is Josh Marshall, and this is the Josh Marshall Podcast with Kate Riga. We have a number of things we're going to talk about this week, as usual. We have polls, we have trials, we have some things that are kind of, at this point, they're almost like comic relief, which I think we're going to get to first, the ongoing kind of implosion of Kristi Noem, the governor of South Dakota, who, by a lot of measures, she seemed like the most, you know, she seemed to fit all of the, you know, check all the boxes for Donald Trump in picking a vice presidential nominee. You know, she, I mean, first of all, she's governor of a state, not a state you really care about in the sense of bringing states along, although that's not really much of a thing anymore. I think it's been a long time since we've really thought that that was kind of anything. In some ways, the last time that got, I think, serious consideration was back in 1992 when Bill Clinton picked Al Gore, and Democrats were still in those days thinking they were going to peel back the states that they had lost in the aftermath of the civil rights movement. You know, Democrats, you know, you got to get a Southern Democrat. That was part of Bill Clinton's selling point, governor of Arkansas. And you get Al Gore, a senator from Tennessee, and you're going to kind of bring back in some of those border states or something like that. Now, obviously, we're in a different era now where you see some Southern states, very different versions of some Southern states coming back into view as swing states. Georgia's the obvious one. Arizona, even though it's not, you know, geographically South, it's not Southern in the sense of being part of the old Confederacy. So, you know, being governor of a state isn't that much. But, you know, I did a post about this yesterday. And first of all, she's got the culture war thing, you know, kind of up for kicking any asses that are available to kick, especially if they're liberal asses. Trump really seems to want a female running mate, which makes a lot of sense. You know, his, I don't know if they're his biggest vulnerabilities, but his lengthy list of accomplishments in the rape and sexual assault field, you know, continue to dog him. So possibly a female running mate can take some of the edge off of that. You also have the abortion issue. Now, none of the women who might be in the mix have any different position on abortion, but to the extent that it is a gendered issue, to the extent that you're already carrying the abortion ban kind of albatross around with you. It doesn't help to add on the all-male ticket, all-male party, all that kind of stuff. And, you know, I struggled with how to put this in the piece that I wrote yesterday, but she's kind of got the Mar-a-Lago look. Attractive woman, dresses in a kind of a fierce way and everything. And, you know, in the Trump era, these sort of, I don't know how you'd put it, like attractive, brassy women who have a lot of guns, that's kind of the sweet spot. Right. And so everything seemed to be kind of lining up for Kristi Noem. And, you know, when I would talk to people recently, everybody, including myself, would kind of come back to she's the obvious person. You know, she's the person who kind of fits, checks every box, you know, fits every qualification. And then, as you know, she came out with this campaign biography. I don't know, it goes back a couple weeks ago now, which is something you do when you're running for president. Right, when you're getting ready to run in the primaries and everything. So it's a measure of how much she is running for vice presidential nominee that she came out with a campaign book for that. Right. So as you know, she has this story. And I mean, I don't laugh at it. I'm a big dog person. But, you know, how she had this dog, Cricket, you know, wasn't quite a puppy. I think was like maybe 14 months old. But clearly a puppy who had a lot of energy, maybe hadn't really been trained, was hired, you know, the dog was hired to be a hunting dog, you know, brought into the organization to be a hunting dog. Apparently it wasn't a great hunting dog and supposedly, I don't know, killed a neighbor's chicken. Now, most of us in our dog lives, there's not a lot of like chickens around, right? That the dog is going to get into a fight with, but there are certain extreme cases of dogs who either have had, you know, some sort of abuse earlier in their lives, or they're just kind of out of control. And even with really extensive training, they remain dangerous to people around them. And that's a difficult, you know, there's various possibilities that, you know, ways that can go. And in any case, it really seems like this is just a young dog who hadn't been trained and had a lot of energy. And Kristi Noem got really pissed and shot it and killed the dog. And, you know, dogs get euthanized sometimes. That's, you know, kind of in our modern world, that's kind of frowned upon as a way to euthanize your dog. But needless to say, that fact has not gone over well, even in Trump world, it hasn't gone over terribly well. And I was watching, they had Harry Enten on CNN, you know, he's the numbers guy on CNN, and someone clipped it. I noticed they had up that, you know, dog's approval rating is 88%. You know, maybe Joe is at 39 and Trump is at 42. Dogs are up at 88%. The pandemic has not, if everybody's upset, they're still very pro-dog. They've got a very strong approval rating. So everybody's kind of pissed about this. And so now she's been on this tour of basically trying to revise the story. And she went on one interview thing and she said, hey, the dog was either going to kill my kids or I killed the dog. So like, I had to step up and do what was necessary. And like, I don't think the dog was going to kill your kids. I think that's probably a bit of an exaggeration because dogs tend to be fairly malleable with someone who knows how to train them and someone who just can work with them in a way to, you know, it's not just your trainer. You have to follow up and do, you know, you have to be consistent with them. In any case, so it's gone so poorly that she has, you know, tried to revise the story of like, I was put in a terrible position, but I did what was necessary and I shot Cricket. Okay, shot him in the face. But if you look in actually the book, the book actually says, I hated that dog. I hated that dog. Right? So clearly, this wasn't just like it broke her heart or something like that. She was just mad. And so she shot him. And so that's happening. And it's one of these things where since, you know, maybe in political obsessives have been saying she's the one for a while, but no one knows who she is. And there's something like 30 people who live in South Dakota. So it's not like that's a big voting block. So this is like the first introduction you have to her. She shot her dog. She thought that was an awesome enough thing that she not only included it in her book, but in her sort of press rollout. included it as a kind of defining moment for her, that she was tough enough to not only euthanize her dog, but to do it in a kind of in a hideously brutal way. You know, things happen different in rural areas. I get that, you know, but still. And then it came out, she's got this line in there about she had this kind of meeting with Kim Jong-un, the, you know, paramount leader of North Korea, and that, you know, he underestimated her, what she was going to bring to that confrontation or whatever. But the thing is with, you know, with Kim Jong-un, you don't see him at like the G7 or Davos or like the G20. He's not like hanging out at all the big meetings. The dude never leaves North Korea. And when he occasionally does, he goes to China, since China and North Korea have a long-standing, very close relationship. And, you know, that's one of the things that was such a big deal when he had that summit meeting with Trump in 2018 in, I believe it was Singapore, because the guy never leaves the country. So pretty quickly, everybody was able to sort of, you know, look at the record and say, you never met with him. What are you talking about? And pretty quickly, her office put out this thing that said, well, it's come to our attention that there are some issues with conflation of world leaders. And the publisher is taking responsibility for that. And they're going to revise the book for when the final copy comes out. You know, that's a pretty big error. That's not like a copy editing error, right? And the other thing is, like, what other dictator did you stand down? Did you get him confused with, like, Justin Trudeau? You know, how many enemy dictators do we have? Did you meet with Putin? So anyway, my sense is that she's done. Because she's gone on this kind of a press tour now of these very, I mean, she went on, I think it was Meet the Press this weekend. And then she did a Fox interview. She, I think, did, I don't know, OANN or Newsmax. She's been all over the place and has gotten very confrontational about it. And that's kind of what you need to do in Trump world. You can't go on an apology tour, right? So what do you think, Kate? I mean, I think that, again, she's just a punchline. This is just, these ridiculous things are all that anybody knows about her now. How could he pick her?
I mean, it's the Katie Britt syndrome, right? Like, not many people who aren't diehard political junkies kind of knew who she was. She's attractive for the reasons you outlined, which are, you know, Trump clearly thinks he needs to do damage control with women. But because he is who he is, the kind of suitable woman can only exist within very tight parameters, which includes being young and, you know, beautiful enough by his standards. And he can't, you know, an older woman is just off the table. Like, someone his contemporary is just, you know, deserves to kind of be taken out back and be shot. So it has to be someone like half his age. And, you know, we're already talking about a party that has a huge gender gap, right? Like, the vast, vast majority of women, you know, in Congress specifically are in the Democratic Party. So you've got this kind of limited pool to begin with. And then he puts all these other things on top of it. And it leaves you with just a handful of women. And so, you know, when Katie Britt was going to be the kind of up and comer, like, maybe she'd be a surprise addition to the list, right? She used to be a, like, Shelby's chief of staff. And then she got the Alabama Senate seat, youngest woman in the Senate, you know, kind of traditional Catholic, was going to deliver the State of the Union rebuttal from her kitchen. And we all know how that went. It was ridiculous. It immediately parodied kind of, that was her introduction and all-time whiff, right? So that took her out of contention.
But at least there, you could sort of say she didn't kill anybody. She didn't lie. You could just say, all right, that was a whoever gave you media advice on that. That was a whiff and whatever.
Much less self-imposed kind of collapse. Yeah. Carrie Lake also, I think, just made herself too crazy to fit this role, even though everything she did was kind of in prostration to put herself in this position. You know, you'll remember the kind of iconic vacuuming of the rug before Trump got to the event because he's her president. And, you know, this is in the same bucket of like kind of her attempts to moderate to win the Senate seat in Arizona. It's just you can't make your brand being the batshit lady and then kind of like come back from that. And I think she's kind of too far gone for Trump. He sees her as a political liability, as does basically everyone in the party.
Well, and also she's got her own big lie. You know, she's got her Arizona big lie. And I kind of feel like Trump realized at a certain point, this is just my brand now. I don't need to keep litigating it. I just won. And if you want to be on my side, you need to say I won. But she's still litigating it. And I think at some level, he must think like, stay in your lane. I'm the big lie guy. Don't do your own mini big lie. Like, it, I think that's part of it. But, and also she's just whack. And, you know.
Right. And so, like you said, I think Noam was kind of became the leading woman contender for all these reasons. She, you know, she plays the role. She's young and pretty and like carries big guns and does the kind of requisite bowing at the altar and everything else that you need. I mean, like you said, she's from this small state, right? It's not like, not to say she's not politically ambitious, but not in a way that I think he would find threatening, which is a requisite. So you had all the stars aligned. And then, you know, a critical detail here is that her team took the dog killing incident out of the first edition of the book. And she insisted that it be put back into the second edition. And apparently some of that is because, you know, small town, right? Small state. Things get around. People kind of already knew about the cricket story. So I think it was an attempt to get out ahead of it. But I mean, like you said, now she's on, you know, she can't cancel her interviews, her like kind of pre-booked media tour to hawk the book, because that's so un-Trumpian, right? She can't apologize because, again, un-Trumpian. So she has to find a way to make the story not despicable, which is why, like the way you kind of outlined, she's trying to say, well, you know, cricket goes from kind of like unruly and a little bit of a pain in the ass to like Cujo. I had to put him down. He was going to exterminate my family. And then on top of that, there's another story about her taking it upon herself to kill a goat, but she like missed or didn't have requisite ammo. So she left it like writhing in the pit while she went to get another bullet or another shotgun or something, which is like, okay, so on top of this, you're also like pretty bad at guns if it takes you multiple attempts to like exterminate an animal point blank range.
Well, and also it's like a goat. It's not like they're like,
yeah, you know, like Matrix, oh, dodging. Exactly.
I mean, you just put a gun to its head and, you know, so like, yeah, how hard can that be to do it in a semi-humane way?
Right. And I do think she thinks that this is some kind of like farmer cosplay, like, well, East Coast elites don't understand, like, it's brutal here in rural America. Like, sometimes you just have to kind of face down death or whatever. But, you know, everyone in the entire world is saying like, well, that's not, you know, I think there is some truth to the idea that like farmers and people who work with livestock kind of have a closer relationship with death and killing than normal people do.
Animals get slaughtered. I mean, that's right. That is true. And animals get put down. And so, yeah, it certainly is true. I mean, most of us city dwellers, you kind of like see a chicken and you're like, oh my God, I want to have him come live in my house and we'll be best friends, right? And you know, all this kind of stuff. It's funny. I was interviewing, doing a little genealogy project, and I was interviewing a relative who is, you know, over 80. And this person remembered an immigrant ancestor of mine. You know, this is like in the 1940s. And it has this story. A few of them have a story. This immigrant, you know, this person's born in the 1870s or something like that, you know, going over for dinner, and they go out with Gramps, and he grabs like a chicken and breaks its neck. And they're
oh my gosh,
you know, they're like traumatized for life. So look, in a rural setting, it is different. You know, animals get put down. When they do, I'm not sure you have the way we do with dogs and cats, where it's done in a very calm setting with, you know, intravenous drugs and all that kind of stuff. But just a dog who's a little bit of a spaz, like, what? Like, right. That's not cool. And also, not everybody fucking lives on a farm.
Right. You know? I think the dog's name being Cricket adds a layer of, like, kind of sad humor to the whole thing.
He doesn't sound too hardcore.
Exactly. And then, like, as you say, then you get this additional Kim Jong-un thing, which the sentence where she kind of talks about him, you can tell she was like, zinger, zinger, zinger. Like, this is a pull quote. This is going on the book. Like, this is so good. Because she says something along the lines of, you know, I'm sure he underestimated me, but he didn't realize I've done my fair share of staring down tyrants. I was, after all, a children's pastor, which is just like kind of another layer to this idea that she like hates things that are smaller and weaker than her. Like, it seems to be like a sticking point.
I mean, obviously there are kind of caricatures of, you know, youth pastors in various ways. I mean, many caricatures are caricatures. There's a reason we call them caricatures. They don't capture everybody. But the idea, the kind of like, yeah, you're seven, you say you want to learn about God, but I'm going to have to bust you up because you're, I mean, like, what? What is she talking about? It's like, because basically it's a camp counselor in the sense of like, of you're dealing with younger kids. So kind of like tyrants. I mean, what? Like, you sound like you're angry and maybe like a killer, like Jesus.
Right. And the problem is just like, this is the exact kind of story that permeates, right? This is the kind of story that gets to the normies because it's so weird and it's so brutal and like has been so satirized already, you know, like if it hasn't been on SNL yet, you know, it's going to be. It's just one of those kind of breakthrough stories. I mean, and Trump has talked about, I think he went on like a podcast or a radio show or something and did a little kind of, you know, where are you at on all your VP candidates? And he gave little kind of hot takes on each of them. And the thing he said about her was just basically like, she's just digging her own grave, like worst kind of PR management, crisis management episode I've ever seen, which is, you know, how Trump kind of sees the entire world and everything from like Kristi Noem's dog to, you know, Israel's role in the war. But so she's done, right? She's done. I mean, there's, why would he pick the dog killer? It makes no sense. I mean, at that point, even if you're like out of women, you're like out of the five women who were ever kind of up for the job. At that point, I think you just go with one of the men we kind of know to be on the short list, who, you know, the kind of universe of dudes that are still actively being talked about are like your Marco Rubios, your Tim Scotts, your Doug Burgums, JD Vance. That's kind of the universe of people, even though it is funny because, I mean, who, if you had to bet the house on a VP pick right now, who would you pick?
Maybe Burgum, but I really want to say Vance or Burgum. I can, you know, from his point of view, I can see a logic to each of those. Marco Rubio, no, it's just he's like, so he's just very low energy and kind of ever since 2016. And if you remember, he wasn't going to run for Senate. He's like, dude, I'm president. I'm going to be president. And he drops out. And then he kind of asks, "Is can I get back into the Senate thing?" You know, so he kind of like gets a kind of like a mercy yes to the Senate. But since then, he's like, it's almost like when you just see him, you kind of know he realizes he's done. Maybe he'll be senator for the next 30 years, but he's never going to be more than senator. And he just seemed kind of tired and lame. And I don't think Trump wants that. And Tim Scott, I mean, come on. I don't know if that, you know, I don't know if that engagement was purely for the primary cycle or for the whole 2024, for the whole 2024 cycle, but like, that's awkward. And like, I'm not even getting into what the story is there, but I don't know. That's just, you know, I said in one of these posts that you have to have like no dignity, but also not be pitiful. And I think he's pitiful. I just don't see him wanting to do that. Whereas this Burgum guy, he seems to want it. And I'm sure he knows what it requires, which is like, dude, whatever Trump you want, I'm doing it. But he hasn't really been in politics long enough to kind of really get the wear off of that kind of Trump lickspittledom, basically, of really kind of being pitiful. The other thing is, he's a legit successful businessman. I think he's in the billionaire range, and if not in the billionaire range, close. So that's two things. We know Trump likes people who really succeeded in business. He could probably put in some real money of his own. And just, I don't know, he's not part of the kind of the Trump cinematic universe. So I do think he would kind of add, kind of like, oh, Trump's got a serious, you know, if something happens to Trump, we've got this guy who, you know, who built a software company and all that kind of stuff. And okay. And then with J.D. Vance, he, I think Vance rubs a lot of normal people the wrong way. He just has a kind of a Peter Thiel, I'm going to kidnap you and chop your body up for parts and sell it off to people as a supplement, or just weird kind of stuff. On the other hand, you know, he kind of talks the Trump predator game. And he also kind of, he's one of these people who takes the craziness of Trumpdom, but in some ways manages to kind of distill it down to something that is like an ideology or something. So those are the people who I, you know, who knows, and it could certainly be, you know, yet other people, but that's kind of my sense. Now, what do you think of the Tim Scott thing? Do you think he's really in the running, or?
See, he's the one that I would have put money on for a long time because Trump loves black people who support him. He loves it, right? I mean, that you have Kanye, you have like Diamond and Silk, like he will take any black person at, you know, does not have to be involved in politics. And if they're a big enough, like MAGA head, they'll be an opener for his rally or whatever.
Right, right, right. The betting markets agree with you. I think he's at the top of the betting markets now. So they agree with you.
But I honestly think the biggest strike against Tim Scott in Trump's eyes would be the religiosity thing. Like, I think he knows that he's dependent on, you know, kind of evangelicals and religious freaks, and that's always been true, but you know that he is personally uncomfortable with them and he personally thinks it's weird. And
yeah,
he already had a run through of that with Mike Pence, and I'm really not at all convinced that he's willing to kind of take a shot with anyone else who answers to a higher power than him, you know, like that's a dangerous game to play. And when you had Pence kind of, you know, Pence is someone who says frequently, you know, God first, God above all things. I don't think that sits well with Trump, and Tim Scott would say the same thing. And now you have Tim Scott kind of clearly trying to up his stock, you know, his stock value by, he just went on one of the networks and was asked about, you know, would you uphold the results of the 2024 election no matter what, and he wouldn't answer it. So he's clearly trying to get himself back into Trump's, you know, Trump's main gaze, be like, hey, I'm not like Mike Pence. Like, you know, I also may go to church, but push comes to shove, I'm overthrowing the election for you, my man. So he's like clearly trying to do it. He did, like you said, the Just Add Water engagement thing because you can't be gay in the Republican Party. So I don't know. I think that Trump would be more kind of naturally inclined towards, I think, of the field of a J.D. Vance. Like, I think they're probably the most similar in terms of like worldview, in terms of kind of power accumulation and a future where it's just for dudes like them, right? And then J.D. also has the kind of pull yourself up by your bootstrap story to offset Trump's, you know, Park Avenue rich guy type thing. So I think that appeals to him. It's just, it is something to think that he would go with like another white man again. But I don't know. I could kind of see it.
The thing with Tim Scott is that even though he is saying, yeah, I'll, you know, what is the, if Mike Pence shows courage, I'll show courage. I have so much courage. But anybody who runs with Trump is going to have lots of moments in, you know, in the last 2 or 3 months of the election where Trump will say something totally fucking insane or do something totally fucking insane. And his vice presidential candidate's going to have to say, yep, I'm 100%, man. I wish I had thought of that first. That is a great idea. And I don't know if, I don't know, Tim Scott, he's like Mr. Positive Attitude and let's all come together and stuff. And I don't know. I mean, that's great as far as I'm concerned, because anything that sort of throws sand in their gear is great. But I would be a little concerned from their point of view with that. I mean, maybe I'm, you know, maybe Tim's up for it more than I realize. J.D. Vance would. But the thing with J.D. Vance is that, like, he embodies a very predatory politics. And that would make a campaign ticket that was, you know, sort of all the concentrated things that Trump people like, hurting people, a lot of aggression, a lot of we're going to, you know, totally uproot the deep state, all that kind of, you know, what is often characterized as kind of like, you know, white male Christian conservative aggression. And I think that, I mean, Trump in a way has that in spades. He's the candidate of those people. But I think one of the things that has always given Trump a little wiggle room is that most people think like, dude, you don't even believe in God. So like, okay, you're just saying this stuff. So yeah, I don't know. But, you know, the Burgum guy also, you know, gets you out of a lot of that stuff. Mm-hmm. Presumably he has a blue check verified wife, you know, or however spouses are verified. And I don't think he comes out of really insane politics, even though he'd be willing to say he's for really insane politics. So that kind of takes some of the edge off. And, you know, look, he could maybe even knock in $100 million for Trump's, you know, legal defense fund. That's not nothing.
The money alone might be the deciding factor here. I mean, in a kind of RFK-esque way, when, you know, it was all like, oh, it's going to be Aaron Rodgers, it's going to be Aaron Rodgers, it's going to be Aaron Rodgers. And then turns out it's like a woman who is rich enough to kind of dump a bajillion dollars into his campaign the next day. So, no, I think Doug Burgum is interesting because I was just thinking when you were talking about JD being the same kind of like scary, aggro, toxic masculinity man that if you go it, if say your last two contenders are JD or Tim Scott, it's like, if he goes in JD's direction, he's going all in on MAGA, right? He's going all in on like inflaming the base and going with the theory of the case that is not enough people are excited about Biden. This is going to be a low turnout election. I can just win with my diehards. I don't need to like kind of bother with any kind of crossover effort, which is how he's been running the campaign so far, right? Like that's how you get to a place where you're kind of like, fuck you, Nikki Haley, and fuck everyone who voted for you. And like, I don't need you, vote for Joe as far as I care, right? It's like my 40 some percent is enough. I don't need to build off of that. And then the Tim Scott direction would be more big tenty, more maybe I can bring over some black people or people of color with this. You know, he is known to be a nice guy. Maybe that can soften my edges for people who are a little freaked out by my mean tweets. Like that would be at least a gesture in the direction of sweeping up more people on the margins. But, you know, Doug, now that I'm thinking about it, could also, I think, be the friendlier face on the campaign. Not saying that he wouldn't kind of talk the talk, but at least from what we saw of him in the primary, he wasn't scary. You know, he was kind of like a
pretty standard Republican wearing, governor.
Yeah. Like I was a rich business guy. You know, he kind of cut, or at least he tried at that point to present himself as on the more like moderate wing of this stage.
Well, and I've spoken to a few people who not knew him well, but like knew of him and had some knowledge of his business and, you know, kind of blah, 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 blah. And a lot of these people were sort of like, they didn't have the impression that he was a conservative, not that he was a liberal, but just like a business guy, right? Mm-hmm. And now he became governor of North Dakota, and North Dakota has turned pretty hard right, or, you know, decisively to the right over the last quarter century. So he either had to sort of adjust his politics, or maybe his politics just moved. But if I were thinking about this from the Trump perspective, I would think, you know, we'll get this new guy. Trump's pretty old, but this new guy's kind of like a Mitt Romney type, you know, mm-hmm. rich guy who just wants to cut regulation and stuff. And if he's going to be out there, maybe softening things Trump says, that for a certain kind of Republican, you could say, okay, this is, you know, I hate Biden. I really don't know if I'm okay, you know, pulling the lever for Trump again, but he's got this new guy. It'll be okay. I don't know. That actually, I mean, at a certain point, you have to, if you are living in the real world, you have to come back and say, like, who's going to control Trump? Like, who are you kidding? Right. But a lot of people want to be kidded, or they just don't follow politics enough, closely enough to really, you know, have that sense.
Yeah. That's what I was going to say, that like, this is fun for us. It's fun for our listeners who are also kind of political junkies to do the parlor game and kind of suss out what helps what. But I mean, this has got to be the most marginal thing. Like, how many people are really going to be moved on their selection by their choice of vice president unless you got some like stunningly charismatic VP candidate who could like energize people in a way that the top of the ticket doesn't? And like, none of the people we're discussing here are those people. I think honestly, more than anything else, what the VP selection gives him is a big media event to be unfurled at whatever is the most convenient time for him, say upon a possible conviction, you know, kind of try to muffle that with a big announcement.
If some other porn star comes for, you know, yes, exactly. Right. Kind of the new Access Hollywood or something like that. The more that I think about it, this all comes with who knows what he's going to do. But Burgum does check a lot. I mean, if you think about it, if you really think about it, the whole thing with Trump is just that you need some counterbalancing, that someone halfway normal is going to be in the mix. Because look, his people love him. The sort of the political dynamic we have faced for a long time is that people are, they may not dislike Biden, but they're kind of bummed about how he's done. And so if you make something else palatable, they might go for it. And Tim Scott, what does that even mean? But, you know, kind of an actual businessman. And I think he came out of software. So, you know, this isn't like, you know, the guy who he had as treasury secretary, just, you know, kind of moving banknotes and all this kind of stuff. It's a real company. It was bought by Microsoft, you know, so this wasn't a nothing thing. This is a real accomplishment. So I don't know. Now, the more I think about it, that has a logic to it. I guess, obviously, Trump would have to know that this guy was gonna back him on anything. You know, how do you know that in advance?
I do want to add just quick before we move on that it's interesting like how different this conversation is than it was, you know, when we were talking about who Biden's VP pick was going to be, right? Like, I mean, there's no world where Biden would have picked a white man. Like, there's no world at all, you know? I mean, it's just Democrats.
I mean, I think he literally said he was going to pick a woman.
Right.
Like I will not, right, it will
be
a woman.
At the beginning.
Yeah.
But like, I mean, even if he tried, I mean, there would have been huge outcry, right? Democrats just like demand a level of diversity on the ticket that Republicans just don't, you know? Like, if he does end up kind of eschewing the few kind of minority candidates in the mix and going for a white man, like, Republicans aren't going to be mad, right? I mean, it's just like, that's the way we do business.
That's
over
the agenda,
here, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, totally. And you know, the other thing to note there is that with Biden, especially because even when he ran the first time, he was quite old for as presidents mm-hmm. go, that there was also this question of, you know, not woman, minority, all these kind of things, but what's the direction of the party? Since, you know, at the time, whatever. What's the direction of the party? Are we looking towards a progressive, you know, kind of capital P progressive future of the party? Are we looking for this was never really in the, well, I guess, what's the senator from Minnesota whose name escapes me at the moment?
Klobuchar?
Yeah, Klobuchar. If he had picked Klobuchar, that would have been kind of like, you know, more centrist. Calling her centrist is a bit of a stretch. She's centrist in the relatively narrow spectrum of Democratic senators. But still, that sends a different, certainly sends a different message than if, I don't know, if you, well, you know, if you pick Bernie, I mean, that would be kind of insane as your VP. But you get the idea. There's this question, what's the future of the party? And that is one that, as you can see, doesn't play any role here. Because what's the future of the party? It's Trump.
Exactly.
It's Trump's third term. It's whoever Trump, you know, kind of puts his hands on. That it, the idea is that it is Trump's party and whoever Trump gives it to. So the idea that you're kind of sending a signal for the future is, you know, is just not, doesn't play here at all.
More of this scintillating content after these messages.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey. Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Back to the show. That's such a great point. And also you can see it playing out because we're not talking about youth when we're talking about Trump's VP. Like, these people happen to be younger than him, but just because he's like pretty old.
But that leaves
like
a lot. That leaves a lot
of
room.
End of the spectrum.
Yeah.
That's so funny. Yeah.
No, that's and that's always been that has been, you know, the case for a while, that you're kind of, you know, are, how do you balance and stuff like that? So yeah, it's totally different.
Yeah. Okay, so we're going to do a quick little polling corner here in honor of 538. Somewhat recently starting to put up their aggregate polling on the state-by-state level and not just on the kind of general all polls for the presidential election level. Right now, I think things have gotten, I think pretty decisively, you can say that they've ticked back in Biden's direction a bit from the doldrums we were in a few months back. As of now, I checked on the kind of, you know, our classic top swing states before we got on. Trump is leading in all of them, though, you know, Michigan and Pennsylvania are like 1 point something Trump leads, which is kind of like a virtual tie. Wisconsin is about 3 or so. Then you've got Arizona that is similar, and then Nevada is like 5 or 6, like a little bit of a bigger Trump lead there.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, big picture, that's the case. Trump has at least very narrow leads in kind of all the swing states. He's not, there's no swing state right now that Biden is clearly ahead. I will note that a lot of those states have a lot of polls from unknown pollsters. And that's not just like excuse making. Most states have some sort of signature pollster that's the one in that state. Most of these states recently, we have not seen those. And I was going to go through, but there's no point. There's a lot of unknown polls that are figuring into those numbers. There was, I mean, just as an example, there was right now in Michigan, 538 has Trump up by 1.4. The third most recent poll is something from Kaplan Strategies, which I've never heard of before, literally until like a couple weeks ago. They have Biden down 15 points. That's nonsense. The two more recent ones are a CBS poll that has Biden up 2, Emerson poll that has Trump up 4 when you do the direct head-to-heads. So again, just have that in the back of your mind. But I think this is right, that look, Trump was, I think we can look at the last like 6 months and say Trump was ahead by a few points for a number of months. After the State of the Union and after the primaries ended as contested contests in mid-March, Biden started making up ground. He got it close to a tie, or actually a tie, in the national, you know, popular vote surveys. And then in the last couple weeks, there's been a little recession back from that. So for instance, right now, 538, if you look at the sort of the, you know, the national composite, it's 1.1. So, you know, that's where it is. And I would vastly prefer to see that as Biden up 1.1 or 2.1 or 3.1, but we've seen progress over the last few months. I think it's still a little unclear whether it seems like it might be sort of three steps forward, one step back. I think we need to see a little bit more whether that one step back is a thing as opposed to, you know, kind of just noise. One other point to keep in mind is that polls come out. They sometimes have registered voters. They have likely voters. I've seen a lot this cycle that have adults, which is generally speaking, they don't release a lot of polls that are of adults because adults, you want at least people who are registered to vote. Pretty much through this campaign, Biden does much better when you're looking at likely voter polls. And so that is just something to keep in mind, whether that is something that is going to make a difference, be the difference, something like that. I will just note that there was an ABC News poll that ABC News Ipsos poll that came out, I don't know, a few days ago. Among adults, it had Trump up by 2 points. And that was, for whatever reason, that was the number that got the press pickup. The likely voter screen had Biden up by 4 points. That's a huge delta for that difference. Not all of them are that big a difference. But again, that's something to keep in mind here. But you know, look, it's if the election were held today, it would probably be a very narrow Trump win. It's not held today. I think that, you know, Biden has made up some ground, and now, you know, the next 6 months is going to tell us whether he is going to make up more ground. And that's kind of where we are.
So my concern, and I use the word concern lightly because I think a lot of what we've been saying for the past few months is still pretty true, which is that for the people who decide elections, we're still really far out from it in a way that does not feel true to me or to you or to the people listening, because we're all, you know, tearing our hair out being like, there's only six months till, you know, the potential end of democracy. But if there is a concern I have, it's that I thought events would have more bearing on this stuff. Like, you know, we saw the State of the Union, and then we kind of had the bump after that. And that made sense to me. That was kind of how I was thinking of things. And then I thought, okay, then we're going to hit at least a trial, if not multiple trials. And that will similarly have a pretty trackable, you know, nexus to what's going on in the race. And whether or not, I'm not even totally talking about polling, because polling is just so kind of all over the map. But in terms of the narrative and the kind of framing the candidates are getting, and the way that, you know, the kind of TV news that trickles down to normies is being portrayed, and all, you know, are we still talking about Biden's age, blah, 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 like all of that kind of whole universe of things. I did think that the Trump being in court every day and not being able to campaign and looking pathetic and being like a step away from, you know, wearing a prison jumpsuit, that like that would make a big difference. And I think I kind of underestimated the degree to which not having it on TV would really, big really, deal. Really big, matter. Yeah.
Big deal.
Because
yep.
I mean,
I agree.
As fractured as we are in the media landscape, you still see TV on places, right? Like, even if you're a person who's like, I don't care about politics, I'm not following it, you're in the airport, what's on TV? It's CNN. You know, like, you're at a bar before the games are on, there's going to be like maybe the local NBC affiliate or something. Like, that is still something that is permeates to at least to some degree. And, you know, on the tentacles of media, on social media, and blah, blah, blah. Like, if this was televised, you would be seeing little TikTok videos of Trump in prison with people like analyzing his body language or stills or something. But all we have are kind of print reporters and like courtroom sketches. And you can feel how much less that is permeating outside of like the political junkie circles than it would have been if we had these big splashy visuals of a former president sitting at his table with his lawyer and the judge telling him to shut up periodically.
Yeah, no, my concern, and it is a real concern to me, I would put it slightly differently, is that I think people know now that these are the candidates. I haven't seen, earlier we had polls of people, you know, like half the people thought Biden was going to be the Democratic nominee, and, you know, half the people thought Trump was. So those are pretty big numbers, since it tells you that half the people have no idea what's going on, right? But I think people get who the nominees are now. And it's certainly not like the bottom's falling out for Trump. So at a certain point, you say, well, they're 6 months out, but soon it'll be 4 months out, and it'll be 3 months out. So when does the, you know, when does the shift happen? I wouldn't say, you know, I'm neither pessimistic nor optimistic, but I, you know, it certainly would have been better and more towards the theory of the case that after Biden's State of the Union, when a lot of the age stuff was sort of, you know, kind of shut down in the sort of the media conversation, and when it became clear who the nominees were, if Biden moved into like a 2 or 3 point lead, then you say, okay, well, here you go. That's what we're talking about. And that hasn't happened yet. And there's still a lot of time for it to happen. And in many ways, the true general election doesn't really get underway till the end of the summer. You've got the kind of 10 week sprint, but, you know, these are real, you know, I'm concerned about it. You know, again, I think about it slightly differently. I'm not sure I wasn't putting so much on the trial, although I completely agree with you. The fact that it is not televised just makes a huge difference. You kind of, you know, I often go to the gym in the afternoon. And so I sometimes I'll, you know, what they'll have the cable, you know, MSNBC and CNN. I mean, I live in Manhattan, so, you know, it's not a lot of Fox or whatever. It's everybody chattering. You're not, I mean, pictures just make a video just makes a huge, huge difference. And I've never quite understood what the whole, what the concept is of court reporting drawings, since there's something about the prescribed aesthetic, which is make the person look a little like the person, but also make them look kind of deformed and weird, you know, which again, I've never quite understood that. Obviously, they have to draw quickly. I get that. But yeah, and I always go with the assumption that you know, you can't do it in federal courts, but in state courts, you have video. Now, I knew that it was not like a rule, but I thought that was pretty much the default. So, especially now that it seems like this will be the only trial, you know, that matters. That matters. There's no getting around it.
So since we're already talking about the trial, let's just kind of bring everyone up to speed. Since we last recorded, the big witnesses were Hope Hicks and Stormy Daniels this week. We're really sprinting through it. I mean, the DA side just said a few days ago that they only need a couple more weeks. And, you know, there's room within that. Like if Trump's team wants to kind of present their own case, they can do that. And you have to assume they will, because better for their side to delay, right? I mean, I guess unless the gamble they take is there's no feasible way to stretch this out past the election, so might as well drop the potential bad news bomb now than in the fall.
Well, I think the other part here is that, you know, Trump can get acquitted, but I don't think any lawyer looks at what we've seen so far and says, I'm willing to roll the dice. This looks pretty good. I mean, it doesn't look good at all, right? So, I mean, I think even aside from like delaying, I think you gotta, I don't know what you're going to put on, but it's a pretty, I have always thought this is a, you know, this is a jury nullification case. They, mm-hmm. they've really got, I think what you see that Trump supporters and even people who are not Trump supporters but are just trial critics, no one says like, oh, they just haven't, they don't have the evidence here. Well, they totally have the evidence. It's really, there's kind of it's not ironclad in the way that the documents case is, but like, we know they did it. So and you know, there was stuff yesterday with Stormy Daniels, like did you say this one time and blah, 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 blah. But does anybody think that they didn't have sex? I mean, come on. I mean, or that, I mean, not to bring up the idea, but like that's just not credible. And the idea that Michael Cohen was doing this for any other reason but to help, you know, to do it's an nullification case. So I think they've got to put something on, because otherwise you're going to lose.
The Stormy Daniels testimony was so sad. I thought, like, I know a lot of people are like, oh, gross, blah, bum, like, whatever. But it struck me as so depressing. It's such a mundane kind of misogyny, you know, just such a snapshot into the, like, everyday brutal wear you down sexism of, like, you know, they went out to dinner and he, like, isn't letting her talk, right? And it like prompts her to ask, like, are you always this like arrogant and pompous, you know? And then like she never really consented, and afterwards she was like, her hands were shaking, she couldn't button up her clothes, you know, he had his bodyguard posted outside the room. I mean, so believable, because every single woman has experienced shades of this, but even more believable in terms of course, this is how Trump would act during this, right? And of course, he would consider it a generous, benevolent send off to be like, yeah, I'll try to get you on the Celebrity Apprentice, right? And Stormy is like, yeah, because NBC is going to put a porn actor on the show. Like, thanks, appreciate it, you know? I mean, it's just, oh God, it's just, you know, Josh has been writing about this a lot, how the whole defense's case is to try to prove that, like, it might be slimy, it might be grimy, but this is Trump's world. This is New York, baby, like, get used to it kind of thing. But, oh my God, you just sad, gross, grim, depressing, sucks. It just sucks. It sucks that we've, like, this man has been in our politics for a decade, and that like it's a coin flip if he'll be president again. Like, God, just how did we get here? It's just sucks.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. It's almost the casualness of it in my mind. I don't get the sense that he had been like fixated on Stormy Daniels for a super long time. He just met her. She's sort of like, I mean, she's obviously an attractive woman. She works in porn, so that has a little woo-woo to it. He meets with her and he's like, I'll have sex with her. See what it's like. I wouldn't even say grimy understates it. It's just, I guess what I'm saying is that his sense of entitlement to it comes off as more extreme, because I kind of get the sense that he was 50-50. He's like, yeah, I'll do it. You know what I mean? Just this, I don't know, just like a...
Yeah, like you're choosing like what to have for dinner or something.
Yeah, or kind of like, yeah, I had someone else lined up for later, but yeah, just, I don't know. It's not pretty, even if it is not, and she has never alleged that it is, that she was not forced to do anything.
I'm glad you brought that up, that point, because that created consternation in the courtroom, right? Like, the judge got mad about it, basically mad that this is now a sexual assault case. That's not within the scope of the trial. That's something else completely, kind of thing. And he right. berated Trump's team for not objecting more during the prosecution's questioning. And I just, this was a moment where I was like, if you had any question whether this trial was all being run by men, like, this moment makes it so clear, because it's like, I don't think she was accusing him of sexual assault, really, or saying like, this was a rape. It's like, this is how quote unquote kind of consensual sex is for women all the time. Like, all the time. It is the most happenstance, commonplace thing in the whole entire world, you know? And so, you know, Merchan getting pissy that the defense didn't kind of derail it. It's just like, well, dude, I get what you're saying, but you're missing the point. Like, I'm sure this is how Trump's like entire sex life has been. This is how a lot of men's entire sex life has been, where like, it might not be a violent rape, right? But a woman is in a position where she feels like she can't say no, or, you know, is being coerced, or it goes too against.
Or at least making it very awkward
It's going right. Yeah. And women are already so socially conditioned to make things easy and smooth and nice for other people that that adds another layer on top of it. So I don't know. That was just a moment that really struck me as like, oh my God, you should have to kind of walk a mile in Stormy's moccasins to understand what was going on there.
Well, I think that what I was reminded of in that part, and I just had it relayed afterwards what was in that back and forth. But in the 60 Minutes interview she did, when the whole story first broke, whenever that was, 2018, 2019, you know, at the beginning when Michael Avenatti was in the mix and all that kind of stuff, that in that interview, she was very affirmative. He didn't force me. I did it of my own volition. Like, that was clearly something that she... You know, there are lots of reasons why that was possibly important for her to say, but she didn't say it in the context of all the atmospherics, but she was very clear. I wasn't excited about it, but I made this decision. And I have to imagine that they knew that's there. So, and you're not going to it's there. You have her affirmatively saying, my choice. I decided to do it. Wasn't excited to do it. You know, wasn't my idea. You get what I'm saying. So I think that was what they were bounded by. But yeah, she's kind of making the point that kind of she thinks they're done. She comes out of the bathroom and he's like there in his underwear. Clearly, she understands what the, you know, what the, in Trumpian terms, what the narrative is, right? And so and I guess he kind of went, you know, got between her and the door. So, you know, we're either going to have sex or this is going to get at a minimum, very awkward. And it's going to be weird. And you know, I think we know this story.
Exactly. And then I think just the other part to mention is Hope Hicks gave, I think, some fairly devastating testimony, particularly the exchange where they questioned her about, you know, you've known Michael Cohen for a while. Do you buy this kind of story that everyone was floating that he caught and killed this Stormy Daniels affair story kind of from the goodness of his heart? And she did some little damning, like, I don't know him to be a kind or generous person exchange. But then, you know, they switched to the defense, and pretty quickly after the just baseline, like, biographical detail stuff, she just like broke down and they had to take a pause and continue her questioning at a later date, which I think was interesting because in some ways, you know, it wasn't like it was the question that had prompted the meltdown. It was clearly kind of, you know, I mean, you have all the human things of this is stressful and scary and Trump sitting in there. And I'm sure that's all like accumulating within her throughout. But there's also the part, it doesn't matter how kind of loyal of a foot soldier you were. I mean, you're testifying against him now. Like, you're done. You're done. Like, as long as the Republican Party is Trump's, I mean, that's it, right? You kind of have to parlay that into what's her name, Alyssa Farah, yeah, is doing on CNN, or try to kind of like rehab yourself as someone who can like speak to the Trump mindset, but yourself is like normal enough that you can kind of like relate to the people who watch network television.
I do wonder though, like, I'm not 100% sure of that for him. I wonder if, and she has clearly always been someone important to him. I mean, I was going to say sees her like a daughter, but as we see with some of this other stuff,
That's a blurry line.
I do wonder if for someone like Trump, if there is a window where that person could say, I couldn't lie. I'm still your person. I will be loyal. I got called on the stand. I couldn't lie. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know. I feel like there's been some other people who have testified about him, not in a criminal trial context, but testified about him without, you know, trying to make a name on the MSNBC circuit, for lack of a better word. And they're kind of still accepted, kind of, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, I guess he does have a habit of, if he cut off everybody who either spoke badly about him or spoke on the stand against him, there wouldn't be anybody left.
It's like a professional wrestling thing, right? You kind of, you're the enemy, and then you kind of, you all that kind of world. And so, yeah, I don't know, but it's certainly going to lead to some awkward conversations. Hopefully not of the Stormy and Trump variety, but you know.
And it's funny because you were left with like Pecker, right? When he was on the stand, he never stopped kind of ingratiating himself to Trump. Like, he knows where his bread is buttered. It's more in Trump's side of the world than it is the prosecutor. So he kept throwing in little things like, and he was the most handsome bachelor in New York, you know, like trying to kind of puff him up. And then Hicks, I mean, probably with this meltdown, probably like pretty successfully at least communicated to Trump, I'm not enjoying this, you know, I'm not kind of like salivating over the details. I'm not like Michael Cohen-ing it up here, but it does, I think, underscore how bad this case is for Trump. You know, if she's aligning herself on his side, whether or not this is going to be kind of disqualifying for her going forward. I mean, I don't think you are crying if you think the case is going really well for your team.
Yeah. And like at the end of the day, there was some stuff about, like, you know, the time our heavy like threatened you in front of your infant daughter. Did you go to the bathroom? Did you go to the bathroom first to clean up, or, you know, clean up, you know, to get rid of the evidence that you've been crying? Or did you tell someone that your baby had pooped? Which is it, Stormy? Like, just like, come on. I mean, you know, I get it. They need to damage the credibility of the witnesses. And by definition, Stormy denied it a bunch of times. And then she said it was true. So that kind of, I think everybody in the real world understands why that could happen. But at the end of the day, she was, you know, she clearly lied at some point. But what it really comes down to is, you really think that, like, Trump, you know, Stormy comes up there, pulls off her top and says, "Let's do it, Trump." And Trump's like, "Hey, I'm a married man. What are you thinking?"
Look at the rings, sister. Yeah.
You know, look. Obviously, they had sex, and obviously, he got Michael Cohen to try to take care of it for him. And those things are just so they're just obvious. So I think this is a jury nullification trial. You need someone to say, which is clearly what the defense is going for, which is like, yeah, this is all sleazy and Trump's a sleazebag, but you're trying to kind of take his being a sleazebag and make it into like election interference. And like, no, that just doesn't work. And he could find someone like that. That's possible. A lot of it goes down to the, you know, to the jury instructions and how much the particular jurors feel that they are truly bound to analyze the case in the way that the judge tells them to and all that kind of stuff. But again, it's a jury nullification trial. I think that's pretty, or potentially an appellate thing. You get convicted and then you go to a friendly appellate court and says, this is a constructed case. This guy, you know, cheated on his wife. He, like, whatever, if it was like about the campaign or about Melania, he gave someone some hush money, and you're trying to make that into literally a federal case since they do bring in federal laws, and it's just not. So that's where you win this. I just don't think you're not going to win it on the facts at trial.
Yeah.
Yes.
All right.
So is that, I don't think there's anything more to say with Aileen Cannon down in Florida, that she's basically now just called off the documents trial. Right. She's she's thrown up so much dust, and in essence, she came into the courtroom today and said, I don't think we can have a trial with this much dust. And that's kind of, I mean, there's some technical details that add on some complexity, but that is kind of where we are. She has accepted for ongoing fact finding a whole bunch of absurd Trump motions, and that has bogged everything down. And now she has come in and basically said, everything is so bogged down, we can't go to trial when we said, which was sometime, it was actually in theory in May, even though no one thought that was going to happen. And notably, she didn't set another date, just kind of, there's too much dust. This is, what are we going to do? I mean, we've known that she doesn't want to let that case go to trial for a long time. So in a way, it's not really news, but it shows you what corrupt judges can do. Simple
as
that.
This is basically just kind of affixing a signature to something we already knew was true. Yeah. Like, it was pretty funny to remind myself that the trial date was supposed to be imminent, you know, because we've all so long realized that, you know, that's not happening. The Supreme Court is stopping up immunity so much that January 6th isn't happening. Fonnie Willis just fucked up Georgia so bad that is probably not happening. So yeah, I mean, this was the easiest one to write off because it's a Trump ally who's the judge, right? I mean, she's on his team for all intents and purposes. I'm sure she's getting herself written right onto a little short list, comma Supreme Court vacancy, if he ever manages to be president again.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's you can do a lot if you've got the appellate branch on your side, but if you got the trial judge on your side and is wholly unconcerned about her professional reputation, you truly can just shut the whole thing down. And even the May date was after all the other things she had done with all that special master nonsense and everything. So yeah, it is what it is. And that's where we are. You know, I think that is where we are. So yeah, that is it for this episode. Anything else we need to cover? I don't think so.
No, I feel bad ending things on such a dour note, but we did all the fun dog killing content up top. So
we got you the sugar high at the beginning of the episode. But that's all we have for this week. And we'll be back with you next week.
See you then.
Later.
The Josh Marshall Podcast is hosted by me, TPM reporter Kate Riga, and TPM founder, editor-in-chief Josh Marshall. The show is produced by Jackie Wilhelm. Thanks to Why Not Jansfeld for our podcast theme song, and thanks to all our TPM members who make this possible. Rate and review us on Apple Podcasts, and subscribe wherever you listen.